that there is a value, and it's according to some even an obligation, to investigate the fundamentals of Jewish belief, and that although there are prerequisites, like having gone through the whole of the Talmud and having developed great awe of God, those will be prerequisites for a person for whom the investigation is optional. He's doing it as a mitzvah. But for those for whom these issues are already open, and indeed, for many, getting satisfactory answers to these issues is necessary for them to create or maintain a relationship with Torah as a whole, so they don't have the option of waiting until the other prerequisites are met. And although it does require a balanced, developed, mature judgment to avoid misunderstanding and misjudgment, even that, we haven't got the benefit of requiring, because people are going to make up their minds about these issues willy-nilly, especially since we are confronted with a culture which takes positions quite different from ours on these matters. So we are in a bid'evid or emergency situation where we have to investigate these matters no matter what, and that has become certainly the governing principle of the Tshuva movement in the last 40 years. Now, we started with the very end yesterday, the existence of God. And I said that there are two different ways that people try to establish God's existence. One is by reasoning from the world, inferring God as the cause of the world or the explanation of the world. This would be what are broadly called philosophical arguments. And it is to this category that the criticisms are addressed when we talked about simple faith and those who are against doing what's called a Hebrew Hakira. Hakira means deep analysis, deep theoretical analysis. It is this that people are worried about. They're worried about arguments based on philosophical ideas. Some are worried because the arguments are difficult, subtle, tricky, sometimes requiring weighing up one reason against another reason. They're not straightforward, clear-cut. And others are worried because philosophy changes. Philosophy has styles or fashions. Others are worried because philosophy inherently doesn't produce very strong belief. Because the arguments are tricky, people like, and I think it's wise to do this, if the argument is really tricky, even if it seems all right, it's a worry that someone will discover something wrong with it. Even when the argument seems, in a way, very compelling. Now, I'll give you an example. There's an argument that was used throughout the medieval period. The Rambam starts the Mishnah Torah with it. He says, look at this guy. You see the sun, the moon, and the stars revolve around us every 24 hours. Well, It's moving all the time. Now everyone knows that for a thing to move, something has to be pushing it. Otherwise it wouldn't move. You push a ball, it moves. You stop pushing the ball, it stops moving. Or maybe it rolls for a little bit, then it stops. Motion doesn't happen spontaneously. Somebody's got to push something to keep it moving. Okay, so now this, the sun, the moon, the stars revolve around us with a continuous, steady motion. So what's pushing them? Okay, you're right. Something's got to be pushing them. X. X is pushing them. No, okay. But then, in order for X to push them, if X is a body that's pushing them, then X itself has to be in motion. And has to be in steady, continuous motion. No, so, you just push the question back one step. So now, the sun and the moon starts going around because X is pushing them around. So what's making X move? Right? For it to move, it's got to be, there has to be a force applied to it that makes it move. So, you're never going to get an answer to this question unless you finally come to something which is causing the motion, which itself is not a body. Because if the thing that's causing the motion is a body, then you have the same problem with its motion.
How so? If I'm pushing the ball, nothing's pushing me.
Well, first of all, your arm is in motion, right?
Yeah.
So then, if your arm is in motion, there's got to be some force applied to make that arm move. Otherwise, it can't move. All motion requires force. This, even we agree with, because you're talking not about accelerated motion. What they're talking about, we don't believe in anymore because, or at least it's not the current science anymore because it's continuous motion. But accelerated motion requires the application of a force, of course.
Of course, but I'm the original source.
Well, I don't think that's right. In other words, your arm moves because your muscles move. And your muscles move because something is liberating a force that makes it move. Now, ultimately, it's going to be chemical transactions in the molecules in your muscles. It's all going to go back to motion somewhere. Without that, nothing will move.
Then you want to take one of the idea that it's like that the whole thing's a clock and then someone just needs to start it?
No, he's not taking it. He's taking a different point of view. He's taking a point of view that, see, if these things go around and around, motion requires the application of force. Motion requires the application of force. A clock has stored up force, right? You have a spring, and you invested energy into it by moving it, and now you're getting back that motion. But there has to be a force that starts it, and that force is going to start with motion.
When it comes to moving the planet around the sun, though. I mean, instead, all we needed was a start, and then the whole idea to do it. Like, oversimplify, it's because gravity's keeping it that distance.
Yes.
And it's going around like this, and it's the reason why it's elliptical instead of like a circle.
Oh, that's fine, but you just jumped ahead 500 years. I'm talking about from a Maimonides' point of view. What you're saying is why Maimonides' argument doesn't work. I'm explaining now how.
I'm going back, almost 1,500 years before that. I'm using Aristotle's theory.
No, you aren't.
They thought that was all Aristotle.
No. Aristotle didn't know anything about gravity in the heavens. Newton's great move was to say that the same force that caused the apple to fall is holding the moon in its orbit. Before Newton, nobody thought of that.
But did not Aristotle say the whole idea that it was heliocentric, not geocentric? He was one of
them.
Yeah.
No.
That was a great idea.
No. The crystalline spheres, as an Aristotelian idea, that all these things are in spheres and they're all going around. At any rate, the use of gravity is Newton, and that's in the 17th century. I'm now talking about the 11th century. So, according to Maimonides, and the medievals in general, if the thing's going around, something's got to push it. If the thing's pushing it is a material object, and it's in motion. If it's in motion, then you have to ask the same question about its motion. And therefore, there has to be a non-physical thing which is causing this motion. And that is one way to prove the existence of a non-physical being that is having an enormous effect on our world. A Al-Yamani says in the first chapter of the fundamentals of the Torah. Now, no one would use that argument anymore. No cure of organization, no rabbi, under any conditions would use that argument anymore. Now listen carefully. I don't say because it's wrong. I don't know if it's right or wrong. But you can't use the argument as an argument because the way in which people think about the world today isn't that way. So when you use an argument, what do you use an argument for? You use an argument to prove something to somebody. In order to prove something to somebody, you've got to start with premises that he accepts. If you start with assumptions he doesn't accept, then he doesn't have to accept the conclusion of your argument. The force of Maimonides' argument, that argument in general, is all you have to do is look at the sky. You see the stuff going around us. And you know from your experience that things move only when you push them. Take those two things together and you get an argument for God. The minute someone says, I don't accept your premises, the argument doesn't work. Well, it might be true. It won't work as an argument to prove something to somebody. Now today, since Newton, a thing that's moving uniformly, I'm skipping over a few premises here, but a thing that's moving uniformly does so without a push. A thing that's moving will continue moving in the same way with no push at all. So the question, what's pushing it, doesn't start. It doesn't start. Nothing has to be pushing it. It's moving just because it always has been moving. You don't need a continuous input of force to keep the thing moving. Why does the ball stop when it rolls?
Friction.
On the contrary, there's a force stopping it. That's why you have to keep pushing it. You have to overcome the force of stopping it. But if there were no force stopping it, then it wouldn't stop moving. It would just keep moving. So already, the whole argument doesn't work. From the way we look at the world today, we don't accept that premise that if it's continuously moving, it's got to have a continuous push. So, here's an example of an argument which, to the greatest minds in the Middle Ages, was an absolutely compelling, simple, conclusive argument, which at least today can't be used as an argument anymore. This is grist for the mill of those who say that the whole enterprise of trying to argue philosophically is not going to do the job because it doesn't produce real certainty. Now, many of you may have heard about what are called the fine-tuning arguments. This is an argument that's used quite widely today, and even non-religious scientists are concerned about this, worried about this, and they have written about whether it does have implications for God. Roughly, the universe is set up in such a way that life, according to them, has developed, but a number of features of the universe have to be very, very finely tuned to particular values, and if you change any of those values by the tiniest bit, life could not have formed. Now, if I have an open mind about how the universe is set up, each of these items could have any value you like, which means you've got, in many cases, an infinite range of values. And if it's a finite thing, a large range of values, why would so many of them have to be at these very specific values to produce life? Some want to say this is evidence that something tuned these values to produce life. Otherwise, why should they be tuned this way? If I was thinking of a universe that came into existence randomly, arbitrarily, I wouldn't expect so many of these factors tuned to within very, very tiny intervals so that life should occur. It would be extremely unlikely that such a thing would happen. Now, in my view, there's a lot that could be questioned in an argument like this on a lot of different levels. Number one, and this is just a specialist item, I'll just mention it to you. When you talk about probability, you have to have a certain background. Probability doesn't exist in a vacuum. Probability comes from certain types of experiences. And if you don't have the background experiences, probability doesn't mean anything. Here's an example a friend of mine gave me a long, long time ago. Here's a coin. Okay? What's the probability it's heads up? 50%. 50-50. Okay. Now, I don't have a coin in a box at home. It's lying flat. What's the probability that it's heads up?
50%.
Nope. Probability is undefined. You have no way of knowing. You have no way to decide what the probability is. The only reason you said the probability of this, of it falling on my hand is 50-50 is because you've seen coins flip. You know what it means to flip them, and you know what the results are from experience. So you say, oh, yeah, I know how that works. Half the time comes up heads, and half the time comes up tails. Because of my experience with those things. But you haven't gotten experience with my box. Maybe my box comes from a manufacturer who's selling coins heads up. Then it'll be 100%. Or maybe it comes from one selling tails up, then 0%. And if you have no information about the box, if you don't have enough information to decide what the probability is, it's undefined in that case. I have a new substance, a new solid, I have a glass of water, I'm going to drop it into the water. What's the probability it'll explode? Well, if it's sulfur, if I'm not mistaken, it will explode. If it's a brand new substance, we made this new compound in the laboratory, nobody's ever tested it before, then there isn't any probability that it'll explode. You've never tested it before. It's not like anything else that you've ever seen. Not everything has a probability. Now you're talking about the probability that the universe will be this way or that way. Tell me, how many universe manufacturing plants have you visited? How many samples of created universes have you tested to see which way they come out? If you haven't done that, probability isn't defined. It's just not an issue. Well, the concept doesn't apply. That's one problem. Another problem is that according to certain models that people have made up, now it's true, they just made them up, but according to certain models they made up, there could be an infinity of different universes. Or an infinity, or a very large number of pockets in our universe with different laws. Different laws and different concepts. Then, ours being fine-tuned isn't surprising, because somewhere out there you got all the possibilities. One of them is fine-tuned, and all the other ones aren't fine-tuned. Then the whole problem just disappears. You know, it's sort of like if you set 10 billion people, okay, well, 6.5, 4, set 5 billion people flipping coins. You'd expect some of them to get 20 heads in a row, because 5 billion people are flipping. It would be shocking if one guy got 20 heads in a row, if 5 billion people are flipping. So if you know that there are trillions of universes, one of them came out fine too, it's not surprising. If you think it's the only universe, then you're worried, why this one fine too the way it is, because there's so many of them. Another thing, which hit me quite recently, fine-tuning problems sometimes can be solved in a very convincing way. There was a fine-tuning problem called the flatness problem, and inflationary cosmology solves it. It's no longer a problem. So the fine-tuning argument to me is one which is questionable in a number of different ways. I'm just illustrating to you why I don't put too much stock in these arguments. I'll give you one more example of one which has now become very quite popular, the design hypothesis. And I'll explain to you a little bit about this, and then I'm going to let the subject go. Can you tell that the universe is designed? You look at the universe and see whether it has in it evidences of design. Now, if it is designed, cleverly designed, if there are lots and lots of different pieces put together in the design, then you could infer something about the intelligence of the designer. DNA, for example. A mosquito, for example. If it was designed by an agent, shows astounding intelligence and physical capability to bring about an extremely complex creature. Even mosquitoes, let alone chimpanzees. Are definitely our intellectual cousins, and you know, all the secrets of differential mathematics locked up in their chimpanzee brains if only they could be taught to talk. That was meant as ironical sarcasm. I didn't mean any of that. All our fanciful academic cousins who think that they can fret animals with that kind of intelligence. Now, question is, how do you know it's design? So, people argue like this, roughly. How do you know anything is design? Definitely, there are things that are designed, right? Give me two examples of things that are designed. Huh?
A car.
A car is designed because we know the people designed it. We know that for sure. We know, we've seen it designed. Computers are designed. Tables are designed. Now, what about them makes them designed? Well, they tell you. They have parts, and the parts are organized together to support a certain function. When you have a complex of parts that are organized together to serve a certain function, that's how design shows itself. Okay, now let's think about a squirrel. Does a squirrel have parts organized together to serve a certain function? You bet. I mean, the eyes and the ears and the sensitivity of the skin and the lungs, all designed to serve life and reproduction. So if you agree that the automobile is designed, you agree that the computer is designed, you ought to agree that a squirrel is designed. That's the only explanation that will account for the fact that it is organized in terms of parts that work together to serve a certain function. Now notice what I just said. This is crucial. When these people talk, often they do realize this. Sometimes they write as if it weren't true, but when the chips are down, they realize it. I said that's the only way to explain how it is that the parts are all there, how the parts are all there serving a particular function. It means this appeal to design is really an appeal based on ignorance. This is very important. The design argument is an argument based on ignorance. I see this thing functioning, and I haven't got any other way to explain it. So I say, well, what do I know in experience that puts together things like this? Intelligent design. I have no other way to account for this. So, I'll say intelligent design did this well. When you put it that way, you realize that inherently there's a weakness in this argument. It's an argument based on ignorance. If someone tomorrow will come up with another explanation as to how it got to be that way, then we would withdraw the design. Now, here's a simple example. You come into a room, and you see, on a table, there's a sack. And strewn out on the table are small rectangles of metal. Each small rectangle is painted half red and half black. And the sack, it looks as if it was just dumped on the table. The sack has some of the pieces of metal inside. And then on the table there are, let's say, 100 of these pieces of metal, roughly, strewn all over the table. Mm-hmm. But, out of the 100, there are 35 pairs which are lying black to red. Black on red. Black touching red. 35 pairs out of the total 100. 70 out of 100. Thank you very much. Now, you say, how did these pieces of metal get to be on the table? How did it get to be that 70 out of 100 are paired off black to red? If this bag had just been dumped on the table and the metal bars fallen out accidentally, it wouldn't have ended up like that. They'd have ended up scattered. There wouldn't have been any pattern like that. clearly I see here a case of intelligent design. Maybe the guy got tired after the first 35 pairs and didn't do the last 15 pairs. But clearly the 35 pairs indicate intelligent design. Why? Because I know that just throwing it down wouldn't have this effect. And the only thing that I know of that produces this kind of order is intelligence. Well, but now I go over to the table and I start moving these bars of metal around. And guess what I discover? That these bars of metal are really bar magnets. At the red end is the North Pole. The black end is the South Pole. Aha! They're magnets. Well, you know, magnets do attract one another. North Pole attracts the South Pole, and the other way around. Now, let's imagine that the guy just threw the thing down on the table, and they just landed out randomly. But even randomly, with magnetism, a good number of them are going to end up sticking together. So maybe nobody did plan that the 35 pairs should get stuck together. Maybe the 35 pairs being stuck together really was without any design at all. And indeed, I think once you found out that they were magnets, that's what you would conclude. You withdraw your hypothesis of design. What this shows you is design is always based on ignorance. I say it's design because I haven't got any other explanation. Let me push it one step further. Why is design always based on ignorance? Because I didn't see the design. When I say the automobile is designed, it's not based on ignorance. It's based on knowing. I know how automobiles are made. They're made when people design them. Computers are made by design because I know that. Shirts are made by design because I know that. Now it comes to a squirrel. I don't know that. I haven't seen any design going on. So I hypothesize. The only thing I know of which produces this kind of order is design. But if I find out something else that could produce it, I mean, could produce it, but in the case I see, it does produce it. Now, there's a way to fill in the gap. Theoretically, that doesn't work in our case. There's a book whose name I won't mention because I don't think you should waste your time reading it, but a book that used a very vivid example based on some moving picture, I think. You go to the moon, and you find on the moon a big piece of metal in the form of a rectangular solid. In other words, you know, it's a rectangular solid. I don't know what you call it, things, but it's got flat sides, very sharp edges, right angles, you know, and it's big, 10 feet tall, 3 feet wide, 5 feet deep. You know.
Like 2001 Space Odyssey.
Oh, that's what it is. 2001 Space Odyssey, right? Now you see. Gosh, how did that get there? I mean, what produced that? And of course, everyone instantly says, it's got to be something with intelligence. And the argument goes, why? Because the only thing that we know that produces that sort of thing is intelligence. So here's a proof of intelligence. Now why wouldn't squirrels be as good as that? Here's the reason. Listen carefully. Let me repeat what I said, now I'll show you how it applies here. Design, in these cases, is always as a hypothesis based on ignorance. I don't know what produced it. I'm guessing. Why is the slab on the moon a very good candidate for guessing design? Because there, I think I know all of the non-design factors that produce effects on the moon. I think I have a list of all the things on the moon that produce what goes on there without design. What makes things happen on the moon? Meteorites crash into the moon, and the sun raises the one side to a great temperature, the other side is very cold, and one time there could have been earthquakes on the moon, there could have been some subterranean heat on the moon causing cracks on the surface. These are the forces that are operating on the moon. Now, if any of them, or all of them together, going to produce this perfectly smooth, perfectly regular rectangular solid of metal? Absolutely not. Meteorites aren't going to do that. Earthquakes aren't going to do that. Random heat and cold aren't going to do that. So I know what's going on in the moon. I think I do. I think I know what's going on in the moon. And I know that the moon, left to its own devices, is never going to produce this. Not in a trillion years. And yet it's there. No, if it's there, and it's not produced by what goes on normally on the moon, it's got to come from someplace else. So then I say, it's not produced locally. It's not produced naturally by the moon itself or what happens on the moon. Coming from someplace else, then I look for things, other things, that produce this sort of thing, and intelligence is the best guess. But look what I'm using. I'm using as my background, my belief that I know everything that goes on without intelligence. I can rule them out absolutely. When I came into the room and saw the pieces of metal lying on the table, it didn't occur to me to think about magnetism. So I thought, there are only two choices. If it got thrown on the table, they just randomly landed 35 pairs together. That's inconceivable. That won't happen by accident. Because I didn't think of magnetism. Somebody puts in magnetism, all of a sudden, the interest goes down the drain. Now, let's suppose we're talking about an area where I don't even think I know what's going on. It's not like the moon. It's an area where I don't know what the features of the item are. So I don't know whether there's some natural law involved which makes it happen that way, or somebody planned it that way. Okay, now here's an example by Ilya Prigogine. You walk into a chemistry lab and you see a beaker filled with some liquid and this Bunsen burner underneath giving it heat. You look at this beaker and it's changing colors. Red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, regular. Regular, like a clock. It's a liquid. That's unbelievable. That's just unbelievable. Now, how in heaven's name does it do that?
Convection.
Huh?
Convection.
That doesn't change colors. Convection just sets up convection cells in water, for example.
Heat and cold, heat and cold.
No, no, it's just the Bunsen burner is just burning the whole time. It's not heat and cold. It's just getting more heat all the time. Yeah, enough heat to keep it at a constant temperature. Dissipative systems is what Prigogine called them. Now, it turns out that there are certain combinations of chemicals that do this. They just do it. They were discovered by accident. It's like aspartame was discovered by accident. Some guy was working on something else, and they happened to taste it. It tasted very sweet. He made himself $1 billion. Or somebody got $1 billion out of it. It just does it. Nobody planned it. Nobody designed it. They just were fooling around, and this happened to happen. Now, you're dealing with molecules. There are millions and millions of molecules, especially organic molecules, which get longer and longer. Nobody knows what their properties are. Nobody knows what their properties are when they're combined in combinations. So, Prigogine said, and Stuart Kaplan has a whole thing at the Faye Institute based on this idea, that there are, in the chemicals of the world, self-organizing principles, where, when you put together certain combinations, they naturally join up to perform certain functions without anybody designing them to do so. That's just the way the world is. It has those properties in it, just like the magnets. Of course, those guys are also shooting the breeze because they don't have any. They don't have any. They just say there are. And they say, for all you know, life is based on these hidden principles which happen naturally. It's like magnetism, we just haven't discovered them yet. Now, can I say they're wrong? It's not like the moon. In the moon, I think I know what's going on. Here, we know we don't know what's going on. You know, every one of you started as a single cell. I hope this doesn't take your self-image down a peg. But, it's all right. Elephants also start as a single cell. There's conception and then growth. A single cell! Okay, then what happens? Then you have two, which look very much like one another, right? I mean, the two are really, one is a copy of the original, right? Just copy the DNA and split. Then you have four. Then you have eight. They have 16. They have 32. They all look the same. So let me ask you something. How do you end up with eyelids and toenails? If all the cells are dividing, 32, 64, 128, 256, and they're all the same. 5, 12, 1,014. I mean, how do you get skin and bone and blood and nerve endings? Well, guess what? Nobody knows. I mean, there are hopeful hypotheses, but nobody knows how it happens. At a certain point or other, the cells just start developing differently. Mm-hmm. So we know that in this area, there's a lot we don't know. Once you agree that there's a lot you don't know, jumping to design as the hypothesis really makes it a jump based on ignorance. Here's the result. How did it happen? I don't know how it happened. And I have no idea of many of the forces, actions, agencies, rules, laws that govern what's going on in this area. So to say it's design, I have to be betting that none of the other things will be able to explain it. Well, how good a bet is that? I don't know. I really don't know. So to use design as an argument, as if we could say that it definitely is design, I think is very difficult. Now, on the other hand, those who say it isn't design, those who say that they have an explanation of how it works without design, are also shooting the breeze. Because if you look at their arguments are full of holes. I have Shurim on evolution, which I point out the holes in evolution. The honest person, I think, in the present state of affairs says, I don't know. I don't know he said, I don't know whether a natural look at the phenomenon will reveal that it's designed or won't reveal that it's designed. We don't know enough about it. We just don't know enough about it. There are people who are addicted to certainty. There are people who tell you, it definitely is designed, we have a proof of it. People tell you, no, evolution is perfect, it explains everything, we have a proof that you don't have to look at it as designed. These are people with little self-confidence, need certainty, rock certainty, in order to get up out of bed in the morning. But the truth is that the state of argument, the state of evidence is so thin that neither side, I think, has a convincing argument. So at this point, I think we have to just wait until more convincing information comes in. By the way, let me just sum up what I said, and I'm going to the last point. So I'm talking now about how good an argument is. I'm not talking about the truth. I'm just talking about how good an argument is. Can I start from what other people accept and move them by their own assumptions through logic to my conclusion? The answer is no. Can they move me by assumptions that we accept to their conclusion? No. Neither side can move the other side. Now, finally, let's imagine a time in which the other side will have worked out its position well. It doesn't exist today, but they'll work it out well. They'll have all the laws laid out, and they'll have, let's say, for evolution. They'll have examples of how to explain in order the development of the different forms of life, starting with inorganic matter. And it'll all be following natural processes. So what that would establish is that they can explain everything on these assumptions, and these are reasonable assumptions to make. That doesn't mean it's true. It just means that in the case of argument, they have a good argument. What would we respond? We would respond that yes, you can explain everything, but behind all of the steps is God. God is the one who set up the laws. God is the one who put into the universe the right materials. God is the one who's maintaining the operation of those laws. Nothing happens by itself. And therefore, they would have no proof that we're wrong. They cannot prove they're wrong. This point is made by the Shasha Flover. They would have no proof that we're wrong. On the other hand, we would have no argument that we are right on the basis of these phenomena. So on the basis of squirrels and tadpoles and mosquitoes, because they can explain it without the assumption that God is doing. So that would be a kind of standoff, I would say, with a little benefit in their favor. They can't prove they're right. We can't prove that we're right. They can't prove that God isn't doing it. We can't prove that God is doing it. They can say that the existence of life or design is no evidence for what we believe. So we lose that area of evidence. That doesn't mean we're wrong. It just means that this doesn't count as evidence. So it does weaken our position to a certain extent if they would be able to do that. But it doesn't prove that we're wrong. To put this in simple terms, is there any conflict? Is there any contradiction between evolution and Torah? The answer is no. Even if evolution were a perfectly satisfactory scientific theory, it wouldn't follow that the Torah is wrong. It would just give us reason to think that God is the one who's behind the processes of evolution. Unlike those who thought the universe was infinitely old, there's no way to square it. If they were right, we'd be wrong. It turns out they're wrong. So this is the reason why I'm not happy with these naturalistic arguments or philosophical arguments about the existence of God, and therefore I'm not going to invest time there. What we are going to do is look at how the Jewish tradition describes God and what we can and cannot understand about God. And for us, the reason to believe in God's existence will come from Revelation, with reason to believe in Revelation as a foundation, and the unique elements of Jewish history, which I think are evidence, but they're not, I would say, philosophical evidence. They're more limited evidence. They're evidence rooted in the Jewish historical experience. Questions up to here? Everybody's satisfied with you. Good. So tomorrow, today's Wednesday, right? Yeah. Tomorrow I will start with with describing what the Jewish tradition says about God, what it says about God, what can be known or cannot be known about God, how we talk and describe God, and then afterwards we'll talk about the basis for accepting the Jewish tradition's revelations that God gave us to understand what He is. Okay.